Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha. Welcome to Science Extra. This is the full interview between Dr. Brian Cox and TV's John Barrowman of Doctor Who and Torchwood fame, produced by our friends at Yada Yada. Brian invited John to have a look around the Large Hadron Collider, the most sophisticated science experiment of all time. Here's how they got on.
I'm Brian Cox from the University of Manchester, and I'm going to do a series of podcasts over the next 12 months following the development, commissioning and switch on of the Large Hadron Collider, which is a 27-kilometre in circumference machine that's going to recreate the conditions that were present in the universe less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. Over the next 12 months, we're going to take a series of, I suppose, famous people around to the huge detectors. There are four of them at CERN: ATLAS, CMS, ALICE and LHCb. And we're going to get a sense through their eyes of what it means to look back in time to the origins of the universe. And today, for the first of the podcasts, we have one of the most famous people, I suppose, in science fiction, Captain Jack Harkness. John Barrowman is going to give us his impression and take a look and tell us where we're going wrong, because he knows he knows what happens in the future.
So far you're doing everything okay. You're trying to go back to the past though to find out where we came from so we can go into the future. That's the whole thing. But it's I'm excited about it. It's my first time at CERN, and Brian has been so kind to invite me to show me around. And the thing that's great about this for me, it's having grown up in households where it's been science related and also related to other things, it's nice to be able to see where all of these questions that we have hopefully one day will be answered. And it's nice to know that scientists, like all the guys who work and girls who work here, still have questions too. No one knows the answer. That's the good thing,
except
Captain Jack.
I'm hoping for some tips. I really am. I mean, it's honestly
true. I'll show you how to work your big ring then. Don't worry. The big ring underground. Captain Jack will show you how to work that later.
Save that for later.
After a glass of wine. See, scientists can actually be fun too. No, we're going to go have lunch before we do all the tours, and I've got a bunch of questions I'd like to ask at lunch to kind of put it in perspective and maybe to help you guys who are listening out understand what we're going to be seeing and why we're going to be looking at it and what's going to be done.
We're in one of the infamous CERN canteens where everything gets discussed and every decision gets made, legendarily. And James Gillis is here, who's the guru of all things press. He has every figure, every statistic that has ever been generated over 53 years in his head. He's like a digital archive.
Mr. Science.
Yeah. I'm not going to live up to that, I'm afraid. I'll do my best.
Where does all the funding come for CERN?
So we have 20 member states now, and they pay the bulk of the budget for this laboratory.
Yeah.
But it's a bit more complicated than that, because what this laboratory does is provide the infrastructure that allows the research to be done. It doesn't actually do much research itself. We don't actually employ very many particle physicists like Brian.
Right.
But we build the big tools. There are 20 member states that provide over 90% of CERN's budget. But we also have collaboration agreements now with about 40 other countries from around the world. And substantial contributions to this project coming from a number of states that we call observers, which are the United States, Russia, India, Israel, Japan. What we do with a machine like this is produce controlled conditions to explore physics in energies we haven't done before.
But right. So when we think of it as being a huge explosion that you're creating underground, it really isn't.
No, it's a tiny explosion, but it's such a small space that those conditions in that little bit of space are like the conditions right back at the start of the universe, and you can see it. I mean, there's a chance we can make black holes here. Right, and it would be one of the most wonderful things that could happen. It would mean there were extra dimensions in the universe. So it would be direct evidence that there are not only four dimensions, but 5, 6, 11 is one of the good numbers we have. But people, if you say black hole, then people think, oh my God, is Geneva going to vanish?
No one knows. I mean, we only see them I see them on CGI and Torchwood and Doctor Who, but nobody else, you hope that they exist.
If we make black holes, for example, and then it turns out that the universe has got extra dimensions, there are theories that say that our universe, this four-dimensional sheet, began by two other ones bumping into each other. So essentially the universe has been there forever, this big 11-dimensional universe, and there are sheets floating around in it that occasionally glance off each other, and you get a new one. And that looks then to the people people on the new sheet, like it began 13.7 billion years ago and expanded. But in fact, you have an explanation for what happened before the Big Bang then.
See, I can understand. I mean, I put it in the terms of what I... In scripts that I get, we have alternate universes. I mean, for instance, one of the characters, Rose Tyler, is living in an alternate universe at this moment while we are continuing this one. And basically, that's kind of like what you're saying is there could be other...
Absolutely. So the analogy is, imagine we're two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional. And just imagine that we live on the surface of a piece of paper, really. So everything, light itself, can only travel on the surface of the piece of paper. So therefore, by definition, you can't see anything off the piece of paper because light only travels on the surface, right? And then, but then imagine this room, and the piece of paper is then floating around in this room. So that can all exist. But if all the forces that you feel... The electromagnetic force, that's light and everything, and this, all the forces live on the sheet, then you've got no way of perceiving anything off the sheet. So there can be sheets, there can be other sheets, you know, in some sense, a millimetre from your head. Right, whole universe. But if no force can go across, then, other than gravity, the idea is, I mean, if no force could go across, it'd be philosophy, right?
But if this might be something.
Gravity might be able to traverse between the dimensions, which would be an explanation for why it's so weak, actually, because it gets watered down. It has to bother with all this huge universe instead of being confined to the sheet.
Because wouldn't it? And the sheet doesn't necessarily have to be something that is mass.
No. It can be space. The sheets of space, in a way.
My question was if the sheet was some type of mass. It would be brought down by gravity.
This is an incredibly perceptive comment that you've made, because one of the explanations for... There's this stuff called dark matter that we think there is in the universe. It appears that there's loads of other stuff around, five times as much as the stuff that makes up our bodies and the stars and planets, floating around that makes galaxies behave in different ways. And you can see it by its gravitational influence. There's also something called dark energy, which appears to have 70% of the energy in the universe locked up in it, that's forcing the universe apart, almost like an anti-gravity force. It's very strange. One of the explanations is that you're seeing what you just said. You're seeing the gravitational influence of these extra dimensions on our little sheet that we perceive as being a load of extra stuff, because we see all this gravity coming from somewhere, and it could be that it's these other dimensions, and it's possible. So you got to a deep theoretical
philosophical statement. Actually, could you tell my partner Scott down at the end there? Because he wouldn't believe what I just came up with. Scott, I just said something deeply profound, actually. I apparently said something deeply profound because I
said apparently, that watered it down a bit. No, I apparently said something.
One thing then, a question for you, and the aspect of the ethical aspect of everything, and I don't like that word as much as probably you guys do too, but how much flack do you come up against with people saying you shouldn't be doing this because you're trying to create something that, you know, we have to look at the other side of the spectrum, people saying you're playing God a little bit. Well, how do you answer that one? I'm totally with you, but I'm just throwing that question into the mix.
I would say that knowledge, understanding how the universe works, is not a luxury, right? It's an absolute necessity if we're going to actually survive in this universe. I mean, there's a tendency to think that if you just sit on the Earth and build mud huts and don't put CO2 into the atmosphere, then we're safe. We're going to be all right. It's not true, right? The universe, if you look at the shot, I love the shots from Apollo and from the space probes going out. You look back at the Earth and you see this little thin sliver of atmosphere protecting us from that violence up there. You know, I mean, you know what it's like. I mean, you fly around in it every day. It's a nasty place. And
very bumpy.
And so only by understanding it at a real fundamental level do you have any chance of controlling it or dealing with anything that may come at you, you know, solving
it happen in the future.
Absolutely. So yeah. I think it's absolutely essential, and it's been proven in the past to be so.
How devastated would you be to find out if you're wrong?
Delighted. The theory for the origin...
You're a little pissed off.
No, the theory for the origin of mass. The best theory we have for the origin of mass is something called the Higgs boson. One Higgs boson, one Higgs particle. And honestly, if we find that one Higgs particle, I think most people here will be really disappointed. If that's the only thing that happens, which is the thing that we expect to happen, in a sense, then it will be very disappointing. We'd rather have much more interesting things happen that we haven't thought of.
What you're looking for is to be explained, but much more to happen that you can explain, that you can look further into and try to figure it out.
We want it to be completely baffling.
New but baffling.
Well, yeah. We do.
That's basically what we're talking about here. And if it doesn't happen, just make it up.
We're going through one of the controlled access points, which are James Bond. Have you ever seen one of those Bond movies where there's just a little shed in a field with a lift, and then it goes down into this underground installation? That's what these experiments are like. There's almost nothing on the surface at all.
It looks like a machine that you'd run your Oyster card through, but then there's these huge big orange doors to get into.
You see, if they had those on the underground, then nobody would cheat, would they? You can't jump that barrier. So we're in the final focus region. So this is where the two proton beams, one going 27 kilometers around one way and one 27 kilometers around the other way, actually meet in the center of Atlas, and you get those little mini big bangs. And where I'm standing now, in about 6 months' time, would be painful. If you want a small hole drilled through you by an aircraft carrier, then this is the place to be.
Brian, why is the whole tunnel itself have to be 27 kilometers? Why such the size?
The size sets the energy. So the bigger the machine is, the faster you can get these things going, so the further back in time you can go. And 27 kilometers, I suppose, in a sense, is the biggest you can afford. The reason is, actually, that when you get a proton and you send it around a corner, then it radiates X-rays. It's how you make X-rays, actually. In a hospital, you get something like a proton or electron and shake it around. So that loses energy. So you want the corners to be as shallow as you possibly can, so they don't lose as much energy.
Right.
So you can get it going. And we're already using 120, 130 megawatts to keep them going around this. So if it was smaller, you'd have to put a lot more energy in.
But that's where they're going to come together.
Well, here. I mean, so standing here now, the one lot would be going that way, and one lot would be going the other way. And that tiny, you can see it. It's absolutely tiny.
Yeah, the little hole.
Yeah, they go through there. Each one is going at 99.999999% the speed of light. At which speed, it's 7,000 times heavier than it would be when it stood still. Such is the weirdness of relativity.
So the faster it's moving, the heavier it gets. And that's because of
relativity. It's Einstein.
Right.
It's very strange. And the other amazing thing is that time for the protons passes 7,000 times more slowly than it does for us. So if you were a proton going around here, 1 second for us would feel like 1/7,000th of a second for a proton. Or in other words, 1 second for the proton would feel like 7,000 seconds for us, which is an amazing consequence of relativity.
Well, it's almost difficult to get your head around.
It's time travel.
Yeah.
It really is time travel.
Well, that's what you're doing then. Yeah. Holy moly.
Well, the protons, they go around the machine in 20 centimeter long bunches, actually. So they travel in little packets. And we collide those together 40 million times a second. So once every 25 nanoseconds, those 20 centimeter bunches pass through each other. And even then, you've got to understand the machine to make the protons collide. I mean, pretty much these bunches of protons will just go straight through each other. And when we first turn the machine on, we'll be lucky to get one proton hitting one other proton. But when we get to understand it a bit better, we can get up to 30 or 35 proton collisions per bunch crossing, which is immensely difficult, actually, because you imagine banging 35 of them together, you get a lot of crap flying out, and you've got to try and burrow in there to find the one interesting thing that happened.
One thing that comes to my mind, Brian, with this whole thing is, like, if I spend a lot of time running, and this would be one massive corridor to run down 27 kilometers all the way around, yes?
It's an extremely boring Torchwood episode. I don't know how long it takes to run 27 kilometers.
We could call it the collision, and it's waiting for me to collide with somebody running the opposite direction. Yeah. We could simulate what is happening down here. Or no, the other Captain Jack. Oops. Just kidding.
We're at Atlas. This is my experiment. Me and about 2,500 others. And it's 7,000 tons of digital camera. I mean, one way of thinking about it, actually, John, is that what you'd really want is a time machine. You really want to go back to the start of the Big Bang and just take as many pictures as you can. But we can't do that, or we don't know how to do that at the moment. So this is the next best thing. You recreate it inside this 7,000-ton digital camera and take a picture 40 million times a second.
So you will actually get a photographic image of what happens.
Yeah, it's exactly that. The inner detector is called a silicon detector, and it's basically CCDs. It's the same thing that's in a digital camera, pretty much. And it just takes pictures 40 million times a second of these little big bangs that we recreate.
When you do it, please send me a picture.
Do you want it signed? What, to John?
Yes, sign it to me. And something about going back to the beginning of time. Yeah, and I'll frame it and I'll keep it in the office.
Yeah.
Because I have to sign TARDIS's things and Torchwood stuff all the time. So if you sign something for me, I'll keep it.
The First Collision.
The First Collision. Yeah. Actually, that's a good title for an episode.
The First Collision. Yeah.
The First Collision.
Russell, please. The First Collision. All right, let's go in and see it. My.
And this is by far the biggest particle physics detector ever built. 7,000 tons of detector. And all those huge things you can see there are magnets. It's a monster, isn't it?
It's just, you know what it looks like? From this end, it looks like some kind of jet engine.
Yeah.
The back end of like a retro jet engine with the and those are the exhaust pipes around it, doesn't it?
And they're still wiring that up. I mean, that's what those guys are doing. They're just plugging the wires in.
But see, what again, what's amazing to me is how do they know what to, how do they know what to plug in?
Because you look at it, I mean, it's just miles of spaghetti everywhere.
That's a cool crane. Sorry, this is totally, like, not about...
Easily distracted.
Yeah, totally.
And so the secrets of the universe will be... Yeah, shut up.
It's a
crane. This is how particle physics detector works. So each layer, it's like a layer of an onion. And each layer is designed to stop a different kind of particle. So you make this explosion in the middle, this mini big bang, and loads of different types of particles fly off. And then the inner bit is designed to stop anything that's like an electron. So particles that are electrons or photons will stop in there. So you'll see them and all their energy will go into there and you can measure them. You know what it was. Then the next layer, which is orange here, that would stop things like protons. So anything that's a proton or a neutron, it'll come out and they'll stop in there. And then the bit around the outside, the blue bit, sees particles called muons. Muons are like heavy electrons, exactly the same as an electron, except they're heavier. And they're the only thing that can get out into there. So you see a signal in there, you know it's a muon. So by doing that, and by layering it, and by stopping all the different particles as they go out, the idea is that you can piece together what happened in the middle. If you're clever enough and you've got a lot of patience, you see there's a lot of stuff comes out.
When you're going to do.
There's a hell of a lot of stuff comes out, hundreds of particles when you bang those protons together, and you've got to piece it all back together again. I was saying to you earlier, it's like really like trying to find out how a Swiss watch works by taking another watch and smashing it up into little bits like that, and then getting these are the pieces.
Like I said, don't touch my damn Rolex, okay?
Our picture of the universe at the moment is that there are just 12 particles that make up everything. So the whole of creation, as you see it, is made up of 12 particles. And in fact, you only need four of them to make up us. So me and you, the Earth, the Sun, you need four particles. Two of them are called quarks, an up quark and a down quark. And more familiar would be the protons and neutrons that those things make up. So those make up, in turn, the atomic nuclei in your body. Then there's the electron, which everyone's familiar with, the particle of electricity. And then a funny thing called the neutrino. And most people won't be familiar with those, but you should be, because there are 6 million going through your palm of your hand every second from the Sun. So that's four of them. And then for some reason, and we don't know why that is, there are two carbon copies of them. So there's the up quark, the down quark, the neutrino and the electron just sat there. And then there's another set of them called the charm quark and the strange quark, and the muon neutrino and the muon. And then there's the top quark and the bottom quark. And the tau and the tau neutrino.
It sounds all like life.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes.
We have no idea why those exist at all. And they're just heavier. The only difference between a muon and an electron is that the muon is heavier than an electron. And then there's this other guy, the tau, which again is heavier than a muon. No idea why they're there. That's all you need to make up everything we know about. So it's an incredible simplification. Actually, that's what particle physics does. Well, what we're trying to do is get back to the basic building blocks. And the basic building blocks that we know at the moment are those 12 matter particles. What we're looking at is the front face of Atlas. Now, Atlas is 20 meters high. So I suppose that's, what, about a 10-story building, maybe 12-story building. It's 40 meters long. So it's just imagine a cylinder, 20 meters high, 40 meters long. Right in the center of that, single protons collide together. Now, protons are unimaginably small, 1,000 millionth of a meter. That's how big a proton is. and they're colliding that. But you need that 7,000 tons of camera in order to contain everything that comes out, because the energy is so big. You bang these things together so hard that you need that to contain it. And that's how you measure something. You've got to catch everything. If anything gets out, then you don't measure it, so you don't know what happened. That's the incredible thing, John, actually, that you... I mean, when you think about how small these things are that you're trying to look at.
And how big this is to try and capture it.
I'll give you an example, right? The entire observable universe, there are 100,000 million galaxies in the entire observable universe. Each one of those has got something like 100,000 million stars in it. Stretches 13.7 billion light years out there. Immense thing. The step in size from that to a mountain is the same as from a mountain to the smallest things that we can see with this. So small thing, mountain, universe. It's unimaginable.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question that's totally irrelevant. If it is that big, the universe, do you think there's other beings out there?
I'm convinced there has to be. I mean, it's almost unimaginably big. There's got to be.
How could there not be?
Yeah, but the trouble is it's so big. You know, I mean, the nearest galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, is 2.2 million light years away. I mean, light travels at 186,000 miles a second, and it takes 2.2 million years to reach that journey. So you think about it, even a radio wave would take 2.2 million years to get to our nearest neighbour. So that's the problem in the universe. It's too big. I'm sure there are beings out there all over the place, and we'd love to talk to them, but they're too far away.
Probably never going to get... Well... Not in our lifetime. Well, you never know.
No, I hope they do. I hope they appear tomorrow. I'd love it. I think, depending on...
Yeah, no, they're hidden in Cardiff somewhere.
If they're all like Captain Jack, I'd be perfectly happy.
I just think of how you think up what to do, what to build, how to build it.
It really is trial and error and practice. I mean, we've been doing it on some kind of scale for, like I say, really 100 years. But on smaller scales, you know, for the past 50 years or so, we've had things like this. And it's just practice, and you get better and better at doing it. And this is what it's come to. But again, the thing, this is what it's come to look at the smallest imaginable things. This is why there's only one, by the way. You know, you don't build one in every country in the world. I mean, the reason we built this... cathedral is there's one big question that we need answering, and that's what is the origin of mass. That's a weird question if you think about it. I mean, what I'm really saying is look at your hand in front of you and give it a punch. You know, it's solid, it's got mass. You could say weight. I mean, people, physics teachers would kill me for saying that. It's not the same, but it kind of is. It's solidness, right? And we've got to the point now, we've been driven to the point where we have to find an explanation for that before we can move forward. Our whole theory of the universe falls to bits at that point. And so we built this machine deliberately at an energy which exceeds the point where that has to happen, where all our theories of the universe fall to bits. And so this detector is, if nothing else, is guaranteed to answer that question, which is really fundamental. We know it'll be answered because we have a beautiful theory. Over the last 100 years, we've been doing this. We've been smashing particles into other particles since Ernest Rutherford in Manchester, the turn of the 20th century. And we've got a theory which describes everything we've observed, every single experiment we've ever done in particle physics, banging particles together, our theory explains. But that theory, if it has a mechanism in it to describe what mass is, because the particles have mass. If you take that theory and apply it to Atlas, to the LHC, but you remove the mechanism for generating mass, the whole thing falls to bits and predicts absolutely nothing. So you can turn that around and say, okay, in order to predict anything when we turn this machine on at the end of this year, then you need some sort of mechanism to generate mass in the theory. So you know that you're going to see it. And we guessed, we have a mechanism, it's called the Higgs mechanism. So that requires, in its simplest form, one new particle, one more. So we've got those 12, those matter particles.
And that's what you want to find, the one new.
The one more. But that's the simplest. You can think of more complicated ones where there are 5 new particles. Or it could be, and you know, sometimes it is, that we're not clever enough to second guess nature, and it could be something completely different. That's the trick, actually, with this thing, because you've got to be ready for something you don't know what it is. So you can look for the things that you kind of suspect, but also you've got to look for the things that you don't expect. And that's when it becomes difficult. So if you could choose, John, to be a quark, you have the choice of up, down, charm strange, top or bottom, which one would it be?
I'd be a strangely charmed top and bottom.
No up and down?
Well, up and down would be going on at the same time, so I think I'd have to have a little bit of everything in me, so to speak.
So the series of podcasts, we're going to ask everyone what quart they'll be. John has already taken all six. So, you know, tell me, I mean, I see this all the time, although I find them endlessly astonishing every time I see the thing, but I've seen it hundreds of times. What was your impression when you saw, you know, the scale of this place?
Well, I came as knowing not much at all. I mean, literally nothing about the entire project and CERN itself. And having, you know, seen it today, like I said, I'm just totally amazed at the minds of the people, and also, not to be silly, the creativity that goes into the creation of finding out where everything was created, if that makes any sense. And you know, some of it I still don't quite grasp and understand, but I see the process of what you guys are trying to do to understand it yourself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's great to break it down into elements, and I funny enough, we were just saying something about a conversation where someone was describing something, and Scott was saying, my partner, it got a little too much and he couldn't understand, but yet when we looked at the basic sign that described what was going on and what was happening, it made much more sense. So if, you know, my thing is really, if you want more people to understand it and to get into it, and it's to do things like what you did with me today, take me and explain it to me in the terms that I will understand, because your guys' minds are just completely woo out there in comparison to mine. You know, I can kind of conceive time travel, but, you know, which you are kind of doing in a way.
Yeah. But, I mean, what would you say to people? We get this a lot, you know. I mean, this machine costs 10 billion euros at least. But, you know, we spent the money over 10 years. Pretty much every country in the world that's got any money has spent that money. But still, it's a lot of money. You can buy a lot of hospitals. You know, what's your feeling when you see something like this and you're saying, you know, we're doing it for pure knowledge to start with anyway? Forget the offshoots.
Yeah, but the more you learn and the more you know, the stronger you are and the better off you are. It's education. You know, the more you can learn, and, you know, if we were given brains by whomever or whatever you believe in, you know, we need to use those to the greatest capacity that we possibly can, and to let it go to waste is a tragedy. So yeah, let's spend this kind of money. We also need to spend money on hospitals and other things like that, but we do need to learn about this stuff. And if we maybe find out what happened after the Big Bang and where we came from and where the planets came from and where our solar system, our universe came from, maybe it will stop a lot of fighting and arguing and bickering going on in the world. So you might just be the answer to world peace.
With that, from the center of world peace and particle research in CERN in Geneva, goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.